Welcome to Consciously Speaking, exploring the evolution and revolution. On Consciously Speaking, you'll be introduced to guests from all walks of mindful development. Spark up your spirituality, crank up your consciousness, and mend your mind right here on Consciously Speaking with your host, Michael Neely.
Today, our special guest is Bob Stahl. Bob is an author, a PhD, a former Buddhist monk, a master in mindfulness-based stress reduction. Try to say that three times fast. He's the guiding teacher at Insight Santa Cruz and someone I'm proud to call a friend and mentor. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, thank you
to talk with you.
Yeah, my pleasure, truly. So as much as I have known you now for a few years, Bob, there's still a lot that I don't know about you. And so some of the questions that I've prepared for this are not just for the audience, but also for myself to know. And so one of the things is that I do know about you, that you used to be a monk. And so but I don't know your whole story. Like, what motivated you and when did you do that? And could you share that with me?
Yeah. Yeah, I was once a Buddhist monk, but now I'm more of a punk. And, you know, it's actually kind of a long story that intertwines with my whole life. And, you know, growing up, I had my first realization that life was not going to last, that I and everyone was going to die when I was 4 years old. And that was quite a jolt in my nervous system, that realization that it's not going to last. And unfortunately to say, in the next 5 years, I lost a brother, a younger brother of mine. He had Tay-Sachs disease, and I shared a room with him, and my best friend who lived across the street, and my grandfather, and who lived downstairs. And so I had a lot of death growing up, and this really, this coincided with growing up during the Vietnam War and thinking that by the time I was of draftable age, the war would be over, but it was not. And fortunately, I had a high draft number, so I was not pulled in. But it was a times of a lot of confusion in our times, but also personally a lot of confusion, despair in my own life. I was very, very lost. And after graduating high school, a number of my friends went off to college, and I hadn't even really thought about college, and I decided, maybe I should do something. I didn't necessarily want to go into the services, and I wasn't really ready to work. And so I was into downhill skiing, and I didn't have very good grades, but I was fortunate enough to get into an undergraduate college in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, where for the next couple of years I majored in skiing, getting high, getting drunk, and trying to find girlfriends.
And didn't we all major in that at one point?
That's right. And I ended up flunking out and got readmitted back on warning, and my mother begged me, isn't there something in the class that would interest you? And I looked through the course catalog, and there was a course description about wisdom of the East, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, and Zen. I didn't know anything about any of this. But there was something about the East that I had a very dear relationship with growing up. And it's a very funny thing to say, but I absolutely love Chinese food and going to Chinese restaurants. And there's something about the artwork, the food, even the vibes of the waiters and the waitresses was very different than Howard Johnson's or Denny's. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to take this class, and I took it, and I'll never forget my first day walking into the class. My professor was sitting on top of his desk in a full lotus position. I had never had a professor like this before. And he began to talk, and he was talking in such a way that he was embodied, even though I didn't know the word embodied at that point. But there was something about how he held himself that I had that sense that this guy actually knew something about life. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure what he knew, but I wanted to know what he knew. And this person was really amazing. His name was Bill Jackson. And he asked us to begin reading the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, The Way of Life. I began reading about the Tao, and I just fell in love with the Tao Te Ching. I couldn't believe that someone thought about life in this way. Resonated very deeply inside me. I'd never been exposed to this type of literature. Mm-hmm. And I just dove into these teachings of Taoism. And then I came across this one epigram. It's actually number 47. And it says, there's no need to look outside your window, for everything you need to know is inside you, to paraphrase it. And it was reading this that really began to sink deeper inside, that if I wanted to know something about myself, I needed to begin to look inside. And that really began my formal meditation practice, which eventually led me to San Francisco, and a friend of mine was going to the California Institute of Asian Studies, getting a master's degree in counseling psychology. She said, you got to try a Vipassana Insight Meditation Retreat. She introduced me to Dr. Rina Sirkar, who's a professor at the Institute. I took my first Vipassana retreat, and it was like coming home. And I just got deeply involved in the practice, started taking retreats after retreats after retreats. And eventually she asked me whether I wanted to meet her teacher, who was an elder Burmese forest monk in central Burma. And I said yes. And on November 9th, 1980, I traveled to Southeast Asia, to Burma. And we went up to Tungpu Lucero's monastery, a forest monastery, where the main source of transportation is ox cart. There's no electricity, no running water. But there I encountered, in some ways, an advanced civilization that was fueled by kindness and wisdom and compassion. And so I ordained temporarily for a few months as a Buddhist monk, and really began to change my life. And then I eventually disrobed, and we invited Tungpu Lucero and his group of monks to come to the United States. And here, back in 1981, we founded a monastery in Boulder Creek, California, called Tungpu Lukabaye Monastery, and I ended up living there for 8.5 years, practicing as a layperson, not as a monk, but as a layperson, but living very closely to the monks, taking care of them, and practicing very intensively. Wow. So that's kind of a long answer.
No, that's great. Well, I wanted the whole story, because I knew little bits and pieces I'd picked up over the years. And so it's nice to hear it all. And I had no idea that you were involved with the monastery over in Boulder Creek. So that's really wonderful. So then you did that for another, I think you said 8 years when you came back. And at what point along the line did you start to kind of make the shift more into what you're doing now? I know you're married, you had a lovely wife, Jan, and a couple of boys. And so where did the shift happen?
It's another long story. And so I was living in the monastery for about eight and a half years. And partway through my time living at the monastery, maybe about 5 or 6 years in, I got very involved in working with the dying. And again, I think what drew me to this practice of meditation was my own earlier experiences of knowing that it's not going to last for myself and for everyone. And then, of course, my brother, my best friend, and my grandfather. So I was very interested in practicing about the mindfulness of death and working with those that are dying. And so I volunteered as a hospice volunteer for Santa Cruz County while I was living at the monastery. And so I started to work with people that were dying and just being with them. And even though I offered some support, in so many ways I was the student, and really like just hanging out with people that are dying and how they deal with it, and learning and being present and helping when I can was been a very powerful experience. And towards the end of my time at the monastery, I was assigned to work with a young woman who was my age that was that had a brain tumor, a pineal astrocytoma. And she had a very difficult situation. Her mother was caring for her. Her husband left her, abandoned her after her second brain surgery. It was just too much to deal with. She had 2 children. So I was assigned as a volunteer, and I began taking care of her. And as time went on, a very unusual thing happened to me. I realized that I had fallen in love with her. And I wasn't looking for this. I was living in the monastery, fairly celibate. And this woman just opened my heart. I think up to that time I knew about lust, but I didn't know about love. And even though she was very swollen from all these steroids, and she was missing actually the top of her head, she just had a skin flap over her head, because when she had a brain surgery on her head, the top of her skull became infected, so they had to remove it. But she was such an amazing, amazing person. And so it turned out that I ended up caring for her for the last year and a half of her life. And if she got better, we would, you know, look at the possibility of maybe, you know, maybe I'd want to be with her, I don't know. But I promised her that I would stay with her till she either got better or her last breath. And this was a very big healing for her. Her name was Daisy, because she had been abandoned by the one love in her life. And actually, you know, you look back at it now, who knows? I mean, it's a hard thing to handle, and so I can't even blame him. But anyways, I promised that I would stay with her. That was my healing offer to her, and her healing offer to me was that she opened my heart to love. As I said, mm-hmm. I don't think I knew anything about love. And so I ended up becoming her hands and her eyes and caring for her. And unfortunately, she didn't get better. She had actually died in my arms. Mm-hmm. And so there was a nurse that was involved in the case with hospice, and her name was Jan. Mm-hmm. And after Daisy died, about a month later, I started going for a walk with this nurse that had given so much of her time to help support us. And it was just so easy to be with this nurse. And this nurse and I, Jan, have been together now 25 years.
That's wonderful.
Daisy opened up my heart to love, and Jan really was my soulmate, if you will. And I realized that that even though I had these inclinations towards monasticism, and I knew how to live by myself and to live as a hermit and to practice very intensively, I also knew that I needed to learn about being in relationship and being in the world and having children. And as I look back on it, I'm very blessed with the course that I chose. At first, I maybe had a little bit of regret. What would it have been like if I stayed holed up in the woods in the forest? But actually now, with more hindsight understanding, this was the best thing that I could have ever done to really open my heart so deeply to love and to fear and to the whole world and being a husband and a father and being in relationship with so many people. So that's kind of
great story. probably not a dry eye among our listeners out there. I know mine even teared up a bit there. So I know that, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier about the schooling piece, but you've gone on to now have a PhD. So what did you study and what, how's that translated now into what you're doing professionally?
Yeah, thank you. And so, so after I left the monastery after about 8.5 years, and then Jan and I got married, and I actually hadn't worked in about 10 years because I was in meditation centers before that. But I did get a master's in counseling psychology, and I got a PhD in philosophy and religion. A very worthless degree, but I was really into the Dharma, to meditation. And so even though it was in philosophy and religion, the specialization was on Buddhist psychology. But it was enough so that when I looked for work, I knew I wanted to do something around meditation and working with people with illness. That seemed to be my interest. And at first I was thinking of doing more hospice work, and I did work as a volunteer coordinator in hospice. But then I saw in the newspaper an ad for a counselor at a stroke center in Santa Cruz called Cabrillo College Stroke Center. And I applied, and fortunately I got that position. It's actually very funny to say because I hadn't worked in over 10 years. And I asked my boss who hired me, the executive director, Carolyn Bliss Eisberger, like, how did you hire me? Because I didn't really have much experience in the working world. And she said, Bob, my husband lived in a Buddhist monastery. And I figured that if you could live there for 8.5 years and put up with the bullshit that happens in Buddhist monasteries, you can put up with the bullshit that happens at the stroke center.
I love it.
That was my boss.
Oh, that's great.
Which I'm very, so grateful to have met Carolyn. She was my first mentor in the working world. And so as a counselor at the Cabrillo College Stroke Center, I was working with people with stress, pain, and illness, particularly with strokes, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, other orthopedic and neurological conditions. Part of my job was interviewing people, helping them to get into the stroke center. Another part of my job was actually teaching classes, and one of them was relaxation. I began to teach mindfulness meditation, and I would hear feedback from people saying, this mindfulness is really helping me. And, for example, one old Latina woman said, yeah, this mindfulness stuff is keeping me out of the convalescent home. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, look at me, I'm an old lady, and I got to wake up in the middle of the night, and I got to pee, and I got to walk to the toilet. And so I'm mindful of lifting, moving, and placing my foot, and I'm being mindful of my walking so I'm not going to end up falling, breaking my hip, and ending up in the convalescent facility. This mindfulness stuff is helping me. And I would hear other anecdotal stories of the practicalities of mindfulness. And let's say someone has a stroke and their left side has been affected and beginning to develop another relationship to their arm that's not working, to their leg that's not working, and beginning to become whole again, beginning to work with the grief and the sadness, and beginning to discover that one's worth is not measured by what one can do physically, but by who one is inside their own heart. And so I would hear these amazing stories, and then I was sharing this with an ex-monk friend of mine. And he said that he just got done reading a book that was just published, and he's going to send it to me. It's called Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And so Bruce, my friend Bruce, he sent me this book, and I started reading Fulkoshevsky Living, and it was like, oh my God, I can't believe somebody has created a whole stress reduction program mm-hmm. based on mindfulness meditation. I'm just totally blown away. And I wrote John a letter thanking him for this book. It was just published. And a couple weeks later, he called me out of the blue, thanked me for writing the letter, said, if you ever want to come to the East Coast and come and meet me, I'd be happy to show you around. And it turned out that I'm originally from the Boston area, and I was actually going back to Boston in about 2 months. Mm-hmm. And so I made an arrangement to go to UMass Medical Center, where I met John Kabat-Zinn and some of the other teachers. And we just hit it off. And there was no professional trainings at that time. But essentially, John said, because he knew that I had been, in the monastery and a serious practitioner, he essentially said, you know, why don't you go back and teach? And you can use Fulkoshevsky Living. It has most of the curriculum in there. And if you have any questions, just give me a call.
Wow.
So that was how it began. And so I began my very first class at the Cabrillo College Stroke Center in 1991.
Was it known at that point already as MBSR?
It was called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, but no one knew. This was the very first Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction program offered in the state of California.
Okay.
And so no one knew about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began at the Stroke Center in 1991. And as time went on, I kept on teaching. And then John told me that in 1993... Bill Moyers came in to interview John Kabat-Zinn, and they were making a documentary called Healing in the Mind that came out in February of 1993. So actually, it was probably 1992 when he was letting me know that Bill Moyers was filming them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be part of this five-part series called Healing in the Mind. And when that came out in 1993, mindfulness-based stress reduction got on the map. And the phone started ringing at UMass Medical Center about having hospitals have programs like that at their own hospitals. And the phones have still not stopped ringing. And in the United States alone, there's probably 640 medical centers that offer MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and it exponentially is spreading all over the world. It's at every continent. So I've been very much involved with this in the beginning, and actually I met a physician here in Santa Cruz, Bruce Eisendorf, who, as it turns out, was a mindfulness meditator. I met him just when he moved into town, and he just had a newborn child as well as I, and we came and had lunch together, and I told him about John Kabat-Zinn's program, and he said, I'm going to help you to get started at the Santa Cruz Medical Clinic. And so he helped me to get a program there. Then one started at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View. Actually, the very first chairman of the board of the Spirit Rock Meditation Center, Howard Noodleman, who's a physician at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View, he called me one day out of the blue, introducing himself, saying he would like me to start a mindfulness program at El Camino Hospital and that he's dying of a second recurrence of cancer and he will not be there to see its fruition, and would I come? So both in 1993, I began at El Camino Hospital in Mountain View and the Santa Cruz Medical Clinic, and I've been involved at El Camino now since 1993, 21 years. And in Santa Cruz, I'm now currently at the Dominican Hospital, but I was at the Santa Cruz Medical Clinic that later became the Santa Cruz Medical Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
These changes in healthcare, but now at Dominican Hospital.
Well, that's terrific. And I also know Dr. Eisendorf, Bruce, that you mentioned. He's my doctor as well, and tremendous. And I love how he promotes the whole mindfulness-based aspect of health,
mm-hmm.
which I think
yes.
is so important
yeah.
and something so often overlooked mm-hmm. as well. One of the questions that I had written down was, you know, what is mindfulness-based stress reduction? And I know that kind of seems a little weird because it mm-hmm. kind of says itself in mm-hmm. its name, mm-hmm. but can you go a little deeper than that?
Sure.
That stuff that maybe someone might not really know about it.
Actually, I love your question. And because, you know, you look at the flyer, it says mindfulness-based stress reduction. So when we offer, before every 8-week program, we always offer a 2-hour free orientation introductory session because we want people to be informed about this class so then they can make an informed decision whether they want to self-select or not into the class, which really makes a big difference when people enroll in the class and they want to be there. And our completion rate is about 89% of the people that take the class complete it based on a 75% completion rate. And I think that's largely due to being informed on what this is. And so mm-hmm. in the introductory session, I actually form the introductory session with that very question. What is mindfulness and how does it relate to stress reduction? These are very, because it's all found in that one title, but what is mindfulness and how does it relate to stress reduction? And so, you know, we can say that mindfulness is this quality of being present. And when you look at our lives on when we are living it, it is in the present moment. The future has not yet come. The past has gone by. This is where the rubber meets the road, is the present moment, the here and now. And so mindfulness is a practice of learning to become more present in our moment-to-moment, day-to-day life. So there's an awareness of what's happening. I'm eating and I'm aware that I'm eating as I'm eating. I'm walking and I'm aware that I'm walking as I'm walking. I'm aware that I'm breathing if I'm bringing my attention to my breath, that I'm breathing in and breathing out. So there's a purposeful intention to be aware and cognizant of what is happening moment to moment within the body and mind. We can say that mindfulness has two aspects: a formal practice where we sit and guided with a meditation, such as being mindful of the breath or bodily sensations, or being mindful even of your states of mind, of thoughts and emotions. That's one part of the practice. The other part is bringing our mindfulness into our day-to-day activities. There's so many activities of day-to-day living that often are going unnoticed. As a friend of mine once said, as she began to look at the workings of her mind, it was often operating in two modes of operation. She said it was either rehearsing or rehashing. Mm. Often the future, often the past. And so in mindfulness, we're trying to be more present. When we're washing the dishes, we're aware that we're washing the dishes, folding the laundry, brushing the teeth. We can bring our mindfulness into the informal parts of our days as it begins to develop a way of life. Now, how it relates to stress reduction is a very important piece. Some of this is found in the mind-body connection, and there's a lot of growing research that understands that the thoughts and the emotions that we feel have a physical reflection in the body. The mind and body is connected. And one of the most important allies in working, in helping to regulate, to come back into balance, is awareness, is mindfulness. So I'll offer you a very simple equation. One equation is that when you're unaware, you're disconnected from your experience, and because of that disconnection, you go out of balance. So, for example, driving somewhere where there's a lot of traffic, you get in a traffic jam, you begin to hold the steering wheel so tightly that your knuckles are turning right, you're causing all this muscle skeletal tension within your body. You're getting more and more activated in a stress reaction. That's, you're beginning to breathe more rapidly and more irregularly. That's forcing your heart rate, blood pressure, temperature of your body to elevate. There's usually no one sitting next to you in the passenger seat pointing a gun to your head telling you to do those things. We are doing this to ourselves. We are our own greatest adversary. We're unaware. We're disconnected. We're spinning out of balance inside our own internal body and mind. We may be aware that this traffic and that I don't like it and what am I going to do, but I'm not aware on how it is affecting me internally. So let's take a look at that equation: unawareness, disconnection, out of balance. The moment that I actually become aware, I'm connected now. So that is the other part of the equation. When I become aware, I'm connected. The moment that I realize that I'm holding tightly on the steering wheel and my knuckles are turning white, the moment that I'm aware of it, I can begin to release the grip. The moment I'm aware that I'm breathing rapidly and irregularly, I can begin to do some mindful breathing to help regulate my respiratory system. And as that happens, gradually my heart rate, blood pressure, the temperature of my body goes down. So thus we can say an equation: when there's awareness, there's connection. Because of that awareness and connection, that will bring regulation, bring back balance. So awareness brings connection, and connection brings balance. Conversely, unawareness brings disconnection. Disconnection brings out of balance. We're learning how to mindfully respond to the situations at hand in a constructive way rather than reacting mindlessly in potentially a way that is non-productive. But particularly sometimes with maladaptive coping styles, some of this maladaptive coping styles is actually destructive. You begin to smoke cigarettes or overwork, overdrink, or whatever that can lead to physiological breakdown. So we look at mindfulness. Viktor Frankl says it very beautifully, that between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space lies my freedom to choose. When we become awake, aware, we have a choice, and we can begin to respond more skillfully rather than to react in a way that will be detrimental.
Mm, I love that. Yeah. And it's so interesting too how, I mean, obviously with the stress element, that's what the mindfulness, you know, is really programmed to do. But then the stress factors also relate to every other piece of our health, of our bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, it can relate to developing ulcers and tumors and other elements that we allow our health to degenerate to due to the stress factor that we haven't found a way to really mm-hmm. just calm and deal with.
That's right. And so we may develop ways that are maladaptive. So, you know, we know a relationship between tobacco as a carcinogen and the probabilities of contributing potentially to cancers and other things. And so, but if we develop adaptive coping styles, instead of pulling out my cigarette, I come to my breath. Mm-hmm. When I begin to acknowledge my emotions and my thoughts rather than trying to fight them and deny them, these are health choices that will be beneficial.
Right. Absolutely.
For more Consciously Speaking, go to michaelneely.com. Sign up for the Art of Forgetting newsletter and keep up to date on the latest blogs, podcasts, and more.
So you have taken this whole realm. I mean, it sounds like you got in really on the formative stages of mindfulness-based stress reduction. And now you've written several books on it. I know you've got your most recent book out now. It's a mindfulness-based stress reduction workbook for anxiety. Mm-hmm. That just came out. Can you tell me in our audience something about that?
Yeah. Actually, it'll be coming out December 1st. I had actually written another book with another co-author, dear friend of mine, Alicia Goldstein, called the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Workbook. That was just working with a broad spectrum of different types of stresses, pains, and illness that one lives with and how to work better with them using the practices of mindfulness-based mm-hmm. stress reduction. In this new book, it is targeting particularly anxiety. And so we're using the concepts of mindfulness-based stress reduction, but particularly for working with anxiety. And often anxiety has to do with the future. And so just even coming back into the present moment can be mm-hmm. enormously beneficial. But we are in this particular workbook, which is an interactive workbook. It comes with some explorations that people actually can write in the book to ask questions about themselves or how they reflect upon their anxiety, how it affects them physically, mentally, and emotionally. And in addition to that, the anxiety book comes with 24 guided meditations that are interactive that you can actually begin to work with. And it's very user-friendly. The meditations come in either 15, 30, or 45-minute length, so that you, depending on your capabilities, you can work with them that way or another. But it's particularly, how would we work with mindfulness-based stress reduction while living with anxiety? And ultimately, how do we learn how to live and develop a kinder and wiser and more compassionate relationship with ourselves in the midst of this ever-changing world and finding our home in it, potentially finding how that we are much more connected with this world than not. And even for the people that are listening to this right now, you know, each breath that you breathe in is a gift from the plant world. The plants are giving us oxygen. In every exhalation, it's our gift to the plant world. Our carbon dioxide is here to feed the plant world. And we live in a reciprocal relationship, and our sense of being isolated and alone and separate begins to dissolve as we begin to reflect upon and begin to experience more the interconnectedness that we share with all of this life. So we have a number of different practices and ways of helping to work with anxiety, to begin to understand more deeply what is fueling it, what is driving it, and potentially ways to find our hearts, to live more within our skins with more presence and awareness and ease.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. I know that one of the things that comes out as I listen to you talk about that, I hear so much of the wonderfulness of your teachings that you share as the guiding teacher at Insight Santa Cruz. And I know you just have taken over that helm, is it almost 3 years now?
Two and a half, three years.
And so can you share with us a little bit about your visions for Insight Santa Cruz mm-hmm. How you see that sangha developing?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a beautiful question. And what has been on my mind is developing the most stellar of wonderful teachings within the Insight meditation tradition to share with our community. And so that's the number one focus. But there's also the practical side of keeping ourselves stable and solvent, because we are a very, this is a very unusual organization, but it's common with other Insight Meditation organizations where we run 100% on the donations of others. We do not charge any fees. We survive by the by our membership, if you will, by our community. This is called the practices of Dana, which is a Pali word for generosity. And so in this last year, we've really worked on developing a stable community support to help pay for our expenses. We have rent and insurance and so forth, heating and whatever. And we seem to have, we're growing more and more stable in this direction. And I think there's two areas that I really want to, that are current really up for me. And one is that really developing the sense of community, that everyone that comes to Insight Santa Cruz is part of a community. And part of the education is, you know, many of us go on Insight Meditation retreats, and we know when we go on an Insight Meditation retreat, each of us is assigned a yogi job, some small job that helps to keep the retreat running, because we run it ourselves through our community. And so I really want to instill in this next year and more this sense of our community, that everyone that comes there, to the best of one's ability, maybe only one can just go on the table and shuffle the flyers so they're nice and steady and stable. But I'd love to see a sense of ownership, that we all own the center, and every one of us takes pride and takes part of cleaning the center, running the center, really building up the sense of community, that this is our place. And I think another thing that I see to come is developing more stability with the teachers, since the teachers are living totally by donation as well. I think this old first generation of teachers, we've found other work, and we've made it happen, so I'm not even asking for me. And I pretty much speak for a lot of the other current teachers that, you know, they've found their means. Of course, happy when things are donated our way, of course. But looking in the future, like, we just can't expect everyone to always be working and do something else. And so really looking at ways, like, how can we support, in years to come, I want to be able to invite in a co-guiding assisting teacher. And it would be wonderful to be able to develop some ways that we can help support the teacher, if not with a full salary, maybe even just like an apartment to rent or something. So I see these are most important things coming up now, is a sense of community and looking at our sustainability to support the center and our teachers, or particularly a guiding teacher or a co-guiding teacher.
Excellent. And just for some clarification for some folks, I know when I first started meditating there, it was known as Vipassana Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. And as I've spoken to other friends about it, now we're inside Santa Cruz, but they still know the word as Vipassana. So can you explain the change and the shift that's happening?
Yeah. Well, Vipassana is a Pali word, and actually when you translate it to English, one of the most popular renderings is insight. So we're actually just, instead of using a Pali word, and people go, what are you talking? They can't even pronounce it. So we're just using the English word, which is insight. And it also seems to be, within the West, there is a budding Western insight meditation tradition. And so that branding of that name puts us in community with our sister and brother centers all over the United States, and in some cases in different parts of the world. There's Insight Meditation Center Redwood City, Insight San Francisco, Insight LA. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these Western Insight centers have the word insight in it. Actually, Spirit Rock actually changed the name of their center to, it used to be called Spirit Rock Meditation Center, SRMC. They changed their name last year to SRIMC, Spirit Rock Insight Meditation Center.
Oh, interesting.
And so there's this whole movement of, I don't want to say the word branding, but I guess in commercialization we may call it that, but a sense of, there is definitely a budding Western insight meditation tradition that is fairly unique, as the East has met the West and is morphing into whatever it's going to morph into.
Mm. Well, that's a great segue for me into my next question, because one of the things of the Eastern tradition that of Buddhism that I first kind of fell into on my own and following it as a philosophy and about a way to live and to be a whole and someone who lives in integrity with compassion. And yet I find that there are so many different sects now within Buddhism, and some have, I think, take it more to the full term of religion where there's worship and everything. So could you share a little bit with our listeners about the differences and what Insight Santa Cruz is and what the tradition that's based in?
Yes, thank you. And yeah, I think in America there's a lot happening in the spiritual, you know, as Buddhism meets the West, there's different types of Buddhism, and sometimes even those teachings get intertwined, and it can actually and sometimes cause confusion because there can be contradictory teachings.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the Mahayana tradition, the Bodhisattva vow means that you forego enlightenment until all beings are enlightened. And in the Theravadin tradition, which means the way of the elders, the Bodhisattva is someone that is aspiring to become a Buddha. It has a directly different meaning. And we can say that all these different Buddhisms have some commonality with, you know, some of the most earliest of teachings about the Four Noble Truths, which I actually would rather prefer to call them the Four Great Realizations that the Buddha realized sitting underneath the Bodhi tree on the time of his deeper realizations and awakening. And the realizations have to do with understanding about the universality, that there is indeed suffering in the world. It doesn't negate that there's joys, but there's also this acknowledgement that there's suffering. And the second realization was a profound, deep investigation into its causes. And the third realization is that there can be an end to these causes and great freedom. And then the last is the prescription of how to go about doing that. It's called the Eightfold Path of cultivating our virtue, concentration, and wisdom. But within Buddhism, we can say that there's three main schools in Buddhism. And the oldest one that is surviving is the Theravada school. The Theravada means the way of the elders. This is the oldest form of Buddhism that has been left, that's still here. There was other teachings within Buddhism or other, besides Theravada, there was some other lineages, but they've all kind of died out. Theravada is the last lineage that's still actually thriving pretty strong, and it's found mostly in Burma, Sri Lanka, Thailand, some parts of Laos, Cambodia, India. And in the Theravada tradition, it's said the way of the elders, these are the teachings that have been preserved for over almost 2,600 years. They haven't been changed. Supposedly, they're kept in the canonical literature, the Pali Canon, the Book of Ethics, the Book of Discourses, the Book of Psychology. And the insight meditation tradition comes out of the Theravada school, the way of the elders, or also what's sometimes, you know, we hear the words, as we mentioned earlier, Vipassana meditation, insight meditation, comes out of the Theravadan teachings. And this is based on the four foundations of mindfulness, the foundations of the body, the foundations of feelings, the foundation of states of mind, and the dharmas of these teachings that help awaken the heart. And then maybe 500 or more years after the Buddha's death, there was a schism in the order. And evidently at the time, there was a lot of feelings about, let's bring more compassion into this. Maybe the Theravadins were getting too tight. I don't really know.
It was a long time
2,000
ago.
Years ago. Yeah. It wasn't around. If there's rebirth, maybe there's an ant. Who knows? But evidently, there was a schism in the order. And a large group of people left. And they became known as the Mahayana, the teachings of the great vehicle of compassion. And Mahayana has actually spread into China, Japan, Korea, as the great vehicle of the heart of compassion. And as time went on, there's different interpretations about what the Buddha taught. Even the Bodhisattva ideal became morphed to this field of compassion. I forego my enlightenment till all beings are enlightened. And so there's, you know, no doubt there's teachings with the Four Noble Truths that are in there and other the practices of mindfulness, but there's some additional teachings that are all supporting the sense of compassion, also a lot of teachings on emptiness. So there's some different teachings that are similar and yet a little bit distinct. As Buddhism also spread its way north into the Himalayas, into Tibet, a third form or turning of the wheel of Buddhism evolved into Tibetan Buddhism, or Vajrayana Buddhism, or the path of the warrior, the diamond path. And this is a further evolution within the Mahayana tradition to the Vajrayana, to Tibetan Buddhism, which also incorporates some of the teachings from the Theravada as well as from some of the broader Mahayana schools, but Tibetan also has its own unique flavors. Of course, within the Mahayana tradition, just like in Catholicism, there's Catholic, there's Protestant, there's Lutheran. Mm-hmm. So even with the Mahayana, there's so many different little sects. There's some sects like, there's a sect in Japan, they do no meditation at all. They're just repeating chants all the time. So there's many different factions with different understandings all housed under Mahayana Buddhism. Even Tibetan Buddhism, there's different lineages and links. Mm-hmm. Theravadin, there was a number of them, but now the Theravadin, that's the only one that's left is the Theravadin tradition. And the Insight tradition is kind of coming out of the Theravadin tradition. That's kind of a long-winded...
No, it's great. It's one of the things that when I first started my path into Buddhist studies and learning about Buddhism and getting involved in it, I struggled across a couple of different variations that I felt like didn't resonate true to me. Mm-hmm. And when I landed on Theravadin Buddhism at Insight Santa Cruz, it really did. And there were some things that you said a couple of times in different retreats and sits that I've attended with you in Dharma talks, in that the Buddha said that if these teachings don't fit for you, then mm-hmm. discard them. So can you mm-hmm. talk a little bit about that?
Yes, those are teachings that the Buddha spoke about in a very well-known sutta in the Theravadin world. Is called the Kalama Sutta, and sometimes known as the Charter of Free Inquiry. And here the Buddhists, the Kalamas, could be like a group of people in Santa Cruz, in Santa Cruz, there's a lot of people coming in, going out, practicing a lot of different spiritual traditions, and we have that here in Santa Cruz. And so Kalamas are kind of like the Santa Cruzans, and so the Kalamas came up to the Buddha and they asked him, what do we do? And so the Buddha said, don't believe the teacher because the teacher says so. Don't believe the books because the books say so. Don't believe by hearsay. He goes into this whole long description. And the encouragement is to see for yourself with your own direct experience what is to be true, if it resonates with you. But addition into this sutta, the Buddha also lays out what he calls a criterion to know if something's beneficial or not, which is very helpful as far as a spiritual teaching. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't say that his teaching is the best, but this is the basis of his criteria. Does this teaching point the way towards greater freedom with the lessening of greed, hatred, and ignorance, or does it grow? And so the criterion the Buddha is saying that if this is a path that lessens your greed, lessens your hatred, lessens your ignorance, builds your sense of contentment and ease, builds your sense of loving kindness and heart, builds your sense of knowing more clarity into the way things are, you can tell from your own direct experience that this is a good path to follow. Conversely, if it's not lessening greed, hatred, and ignorance, you can deduct that this is not that beneficial. So I love how that, he also offers us a criterion based mm-hmm. on, and Theravada and Buddhism is really the most psychological of the different teachings. It's not based on blind faith, but on your own investigation into the way things are and building the sense of confidence through your own direct experience. And it's very psychologically based. It's based on these psychological elements of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And where do they exist? They exist in our eyes and our nose and our tongue and our ears and our sensations and our mind states and our practices to bring awareness to help purify the mind, to lessen the greed, hatred, and ignorance, and to grow with greater contentment, loving kindness, and heart, and to see things very clearly.
Mm. I think those, the elements that you just mentioned, that is the key draw to me about mm-hmm. Theravadin Buddhism and the reason that I finally feel like I found a home in it, mm-hmm. because it does resonate true to me. Mm-hmm. So I really love that. So another piece, we've talked about the mindfulness aspects of, both stress reduction, but then also in your spiritual path and pursuing, your Buddhist teachings. And I know that I've spoken to a lot of people who just say, I can't meditate. I can't quiet my mind. And I feel like they beat themselves up a little bit about that. And I've learned differently. I've learned that that's not the way. And so I'd love it if you could share something about that for people, about what is good meditation or right meditation or anything along those lines, just kind of set their mind at ease about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, may we begin to befriend that part of ourselves that's hard on ourselves. And I want to remind people that meditation is about you. It's not about some technique. And it's about the working of your own heart. And so can you begin this practice with a befriending? And it doesn't matter whether you keep your mind on the breath or not, because the mind will wander anyways. But what's your relationship to yourself? And can I begin to open with a greater sense of kindness in this process of the meditation? So I think that is probably the most important thing, and perhaps not to expect anything. You'll just see what happens.
You know, it's and I've loved it doing the sits that I've sat with you. You have such an understanding, and you've explained it to me and to other practitioners that your mind is going to do what it's going to do, and that there's no that it's okay to just observe it and sit with that and not beat yourselves up. Because I think so many people really, they think, oh, well, I'm not doing it right because my mind isn't quiet.
Yeah.
And then they stop meditating. Yeah. And
yeah, we can say that maybe the meditation boils down to one word, and that is allow.
Hmm.
Experience and allow. And there's actually a beautiful thing from Achen Cha that says, keep your mind still in any surrounding like a clear forest pool, and all kinds of wonderful and strange and mysterious animals will come and go, but you will be still. And in time, you will come to understand the nature of things, and you will know the peace and the happiness of one who's awakened. And this refers to these strange and mysterious animals are the fabrics of our own mind. And if we learning to grasp at nothing and resist nothing, allowing, letting be, things begin to settle. I often joke around with it. At Christmas time, there's those Frosty the Snowmen, and you shake them up in that little globe, and you know stuff's flying everywhere. But what you don't know is Frosty's a meditator from way back and just sits very still. And gradually, those little particles come down. In some ways, in meditation, we sit and we stop, and someone's like shaking us up. There's like mind states and thoughts and sounds. Everything's there, and yes, it's there, and we just allow, let things go their own course, their own way. Gradually, in time, things begin to settle. Can we develop a loving relationship with ourselves, with our hearts, befriending even the craziness of the mind? Just allow, give it space, just like the sky gives space to the biggest of storms. Gradually, the Category 5 turns and dissipates to a Category 4, to a 3, to a 1. Giving space, allow. Be kind.
Beautiful. We're about the end of our time limit here, and we're going to wrap this up, but I want to ask, and I hate to put you on the spot with this, but if there is just one golden nugget of wisdom that you could share with our listeners today, something that they could do maybe right now or throughout the day to take with them and put into use in their lives, what would it be?
Be kind to yourself and to your heart. When I think of all the years I spent living with those monks doing very austere practices, It came down to kindness and heart. And for ourselves, don't let meditation, as one meditation teacher, Bob Sharple, says, don't let it become another subtle aggression of self-improvement that wraps your lives in a knot. How about meditation as an act of love? How about it as kindness for ourselves and to all beings? Because every one of us has our load to bear. So I say kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Naomi Shihab Nye says, and then it's only kindness that makes sense anymore after you've seen and been with the pain.
That's lovely. Thank you, Bob, so much for joining us today. It's been a true pleasure. I look forward to seeing you every time I come to the Sangha and every retreat, and just your presence is wonderful. You're such a great mentor.
Thank you. And Michael, you have a beautiful heart. I appreciate always seeing you too.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Consciously Speaking with Michael Neely. Tune in here for enlightening conversations with people from all walks of the mindful evolution. Our upcoming guests include Grace Clayton from One Shift, Diana Chapman from the Conscious Leadership Group, and Ben Saltzman from Touched and Transformed. Thanks for listening. Until next time, live without limits.